RealArian.com.
The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Medievalist, where we deal with everything Russian, and we deal with Russia's role against the New World Order from the point of view of history, of theology, philosophy, literature, and everything else. And I want you guys to know that the way we're running this show is, for the most part, we're taking each show as a single topic, dealing with a single issue, and we're going to be all over the place here. And the show after show is going to be dealing with the Soviet era, going to be dealing with the medieval era, religious issues, 19th century literature, modern politics and affairs, and everything else. And it's really, we're going to be bouncing around a lot, and it's really based on what I'm interested in doing a certain day, as well as what's being generally neglected out there, and especially amongst us who have as our role the attack on the New World Order and everything it represents. So for today, we're going to be dealing with someone who doesn't get a lot of attention, but who deserves a lot of attention, and that's Leonid Brezhnev, the second-to-last dictator of the Soviet Union. And the reason I want to deal with him today, of course, he is Nikita Khrushchev's successor, and he is dominant in the late 60s and 70s in the Soviet Union. I want to deal with him because, for the most part, he's ignored, and yet there's a lot of interesting things that happen in this time concerning Russian history and the Soviet Union. But even more than that, Leonid Brezhnev is the beginning of the end for the USSR, and for that by itself, it's necessary that we deal with him. So we will deal with Leonid Brezhnev today, and we're going to deal with him as the beginning of the end of the USSR. Now, Khrushchev is going to be removed, and we're going to deal with him some other time. Khrushchev is going to be removed in 1964. He's going to be removed because of his erratic behavior, because of dissatisfaction with his policies abroad, and he's going to be overthrown by the KGB, and Leonid Brezhnev is going to be put in his place. There's two things about Brezhnev that made him an ideal choice, the KGB organization, to succeed Khrushchev. First of all, Brezhnev is very close to the military establishment. This is a big deal. And the second thing, equally a big deal, Brezhnev's particular area of specialization, remember this is in the mid-60s now, is in military production as it concerns the space race. So he is a major figure in satellite technology and everything else. So early on, you have several things. You have Brezhnev as the KGB man, you have him as the military's man, and specifically you have him as someone who's trusted by the high-tech sector of the military apparatus. This is sort of a big deal. You have two people. You have two eccentric people around him in the 1960s that are worth discussing. The first is Alexei Kosygin, who was premier at the time, and someone who's less well-known, an Armenian, by the name of Anastas Mikoyan. Kosygin is one of these people who, and this is a continuous struggle in Soviet history, and we're going to deal with this quite a bit on this show. But Kosygin wants to move away from heavy industry. You guys got to remember that from the late 20s, from the beginning of the Stalin era, right up into the era that we're dealing with, heavy industry is almost like a holy grail in Soviet politics. Heavy industry is something that's considered the basis of all industrialization. If the Soviet Union is ever going to develop a sort of a socialism that is going to expand into consumer production, then the industrial base, the base of heavy industry, tool production, iron, oil extraction, the production of steel, this sort of thing, has to be at its basis. The heavy industry has been central to the Soviet experience from the beginning. Kosygin, like Khrushchev, holds that it's time now, mid-60s, to move away from the domination of heavy industry. This is one of the many reasons that Khrushchev has been removed in 1964. He believes that it's time for the consumer sector to be developed at the expense of heavy industry. And the heavy industry has developed sufficiently that more popular pressure can be dealt with. And you got to remember, the distinction between heavy industry on the one hand, consumer preferences on the other, is just that. It's a matter of consumer preferences. The move from heavy industry is a concession to the popular mood. The move away from heavy industry is somewhat, and you know, given the weird world of Soviet politics, it has something to do, very much to do, with democracy. People want consumer goods. People are envious of life in the West. And this is particularly the case in Eastern Europe, where you have people who live very close to the West, such as in East Germany, who are aware of the standard of living. You know, by 1964, it was very, very clear that Western Europe was way ahead of the Soviet bloc. Places like South Korea were way ahead of North Korea. That places like Japan and Taiwan were doing far better than Soviet Asian countries. And the fact is that the Soviet Union was hurting. This is one of the we got to remember, this is the beginning of the end of the Soviet system. Kosygin and Khrushchev are known for their advocacy of consumer production, the things that people actually want, rather than the very state-centered concept of heavy industry, tightly centralized economic structures controlled entirely by the party and the military establishment. So we're talking about things that, you know, sound purely economic, the distinction between heavy industry and consumer goods, but the political ramifications of both of those movements are substantial. Generally speaking, in the mid-60s, people who support the development of consumer industries, things that fill the stores, things that people want to buy, are those who believe that it's time to begin responding to popular pressure for consumer goods. On the other hand, those that want to maintain the stress on heavy industry, particularly at the insistence of the military establishment, are those that have no interest in responding to popular pressure. And in fact, these are people who look to the Stalinist era with a certain degree of nostalgia, and Brezhnev is one of those people. Kosygin will eventually engage in a struggle with Brezhnev, but you also have the person of Mikoyan. Mikoyan is a foreign minister, so to speak. He is somebody concerned with Soviet foreign policy, and he's very famous, really, for one thing. He's the guy who writes the secret speech for Nikita Khrushchev, 1954, denouncing Stalin. So you have these two guys around the early years of Brezhnev, Kosygin and Mikoyan, and you know, they're also involved in what this political struggle is. Stalin's been dead for a long time. Khrushchev is now in disgrace. What is the direction of Soviet policy? Do we imitate the West? Do we respond to popular pressure? Do we attempt to compete on the basis of consumer preferences, or do we maintain the tightly centralized organization of the Stalinist era? Mikoyan is somebody, and we're going to deal with the Armenians some other time in this show. They're an extremely interesting group of people, really the highest performing of all of the Soviet nationalities, as well as the Georgians. Mikoyan comes from the Armenian population, and he's one of these guys who is holding to a more liberal course in terms of Soviet foreign policy. Khrushchev sends him to Hungary in 1956. And as Mikoyan is dealing with the Hungarian revolutionaries in this era, he is opposing Soviet military intervention there. And he makes himself very well known. In fact, Mikoyan is somewhat popular in the West. He's popular in the West because he is an advocate of more liberal policies in terms of the Cold War. He is also a close ally of Khrushchev, just like Kosygin is. He is an opponent of Khrushchev's policy in Cuba. And it's really the perceived, particularly from the military point of view, the perceived loss of face over the Cuban situation. That is one of the things that will lead to Khrushchev's downfall. Mikoyan really wanted a very liberal line on Cuba. He didn't believe that Khrushchev gave sufficiently in the Cuban situation. In fact, and he is sent as a sort of an ambassador to the Soviet Union in 1959 by Khrushchev to negotiate that situation. And he has the reputation of being more or less pro-American, I mean, relative to your typical political establishment figures in the Soviet Union at the time. So Kosygin and Mikoyan are around and are very important figures, 1964-65, when Khrushchev is eliminated and Brezhnev is brought to power by the KGB and by the military establishment. But, you know, these people will remain important figures. They will struggle with Brezhnev. They will fail in their struggle with Brezhnev. But at the same time, they represent, the two poles in Soviet life at the time. Brezhnev and the KGB on the one hand, Mikoyan, Kosygin, Khrushchev on the other hand. The removal of Khrushchev in 1964 is absolutely crucial in the development of Soviet politics, because it says now the Stalinist wing has gained power. The Stalinist wing has rebuilt itself after Khrushchev's denunciation of Stalin, 1953-1954. Brezhnev is this figure that is supposed to symbolize the reality of the resurgence of the Stalinist point of view in Soviet politics.
Don't go away, because there's more on The Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to The Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
One year after the overthrow of Khrushchev, Brezhnev makes a very important speech. The speech in 1965 is the first time that Stalin has been publicly praised by a major political figure since 1953. Once the funeral is over and the obligatory platitudes have been uttered, Leonid Brezhnev, 1965, makes the first pro-Stalin speech in Soviet history since Khrushchev's official denunciation of Stalin, really not too long after the funeral. A speech is made in 1965. Now the world knows, and especially the party, those who support Khrushchev, Kosygin, Mikoyan, these people are now put on notice. Things are changing. Khrushchev was wrong. We are going back to the wartime model of Soviet economic development. The first major figure that he promotes is Yuri Andropov. Yuri Andropov, as most of you know, is briefly a Soviet dictator in the early 1980s. He dies very soon after that. He is put in charge of the KGB. He will be KGB chief really from the mid-60s straight up to when he himself becomes dictator in the very early 1980s when Brezhnev dies. And Andropov and Chernenko will be in very quick succession dictators of the USSR at the behest of the KGB up until 1985 when Mikhail Gorbachev is placed at the helm. The problem is, speech of 1965, the promotion of Andropov, it's very clear that Stalinism is back. There's only one small problem. Problem is, Brezhnev does not have the ability. He does not have the ruthlessness. He does not have that kind of mysterious charisma that Stalin had. Mid-1960s, Brezhnev will engage in a few show trials similar to the Stalinist era. Brezhnev will orchestrate the attack on Czechoslovakia in 1968. So these are the early struggles in Soviet politics that bring the Soviet Union back to a certain level of Stalinism, so to speak. He just doesn't have the ability. You have the promotion of Andropov. You have a very brief resurgence of the show trials. Supporters of Mikoyan and Kosygin are put on trial. Many of the camps are rebuilt and filled with new prisoners. Of course, 1968, the military attack on Czechoslovakia. All of these are symbols of the reality of a return to Stalinism in Soviet life. However, as life goes on, Brezhnev will surprise his Stalinist allies with two things. First of all, he will support a reduction in nuclear weapons. In fact, he will support, at least in his rhetoric, a freezing of nuclear weapons production along with the United States. In 1975, he'll do something else. He will sign the Helsinki Accords. Helsinki Accords become a weapon for Soviet dissidents from its signing in 75 to the fall of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. So Brezhnev has now turned his back on his Stalinist allies, so to speak. How sincere he is another matter. Of course, the Helsinki Accords are never actually put in force in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union signs the freeze in the production of nuclear weapons for a very short period of time, but only because it's clear that the USSR is not going to win that battle either. The Helsinki Accords say four specific things. Number one, that the USSR may not use force or threaten force against any of its so-called allies in Central Asia or Eastern Europe. Of course, that will go out the window in 1979 when he invades Afghanistan. Similar to this no threat of force notion, and no threat of force also has to do with the United States and really is meant to be a break on Soviet foreign policy. Brezhnev has no interest in following it, but he makes a big show of talking about it. This is just a few years after the invasion of Czechoslovakia. A second element in the Helsinki Accords is non-intervention in the internal politics of the allies of the USSR. which, of course, is ridiculous. Brezhnev has no desire to let Eastern Europe go its own way. But this is a huge propaganda coup. Thirdly, it is meant to guarantee freedom of thought, that is to say, and especially freedom of religion, freedom of political ideas, freedom of publication. And lastly, the Helsinki Accords mandate self-determination for all ethnic groups within the USSR, as well as all the states within the Soviet orbit. Brezhnev will sign these accords in 1975 without any possibility of putting them in place. However, these two things, the desire to come to some kind of an agreement with Richard Nixon in nuclear weapons production, and the signing of the Helsinki Accords frightens certain elements within the Soviet military establishment. It's fairly clear that Brezhnev signed the Helsinki Accords solely as a propaganda coup. At the same time, the Nixon administration is fairly certain that the only real reason that Brezhnev gives a damn about weapons control and arms control is that the Soviet economy is in a lot of trouble. More than this, though, Brezhnev likes the idea of putting a new face on Soviet politics in the mid-70s. Nixon has just resigned office in the United States. American politics is in disarray. It's not a bad idea, 1975, to score a major propaganda coup against the United States by signing the Helsinki Accords. So from that point of view, it's vaguely successful. But the problem with Helsinki is that dissident groups within the Soviet Union now will use the signing of the Helsinki Accords as a weapon against the Brezhnev government. Organizations will spring up throughout the Soviet Union claiming that we now have the right to exist based on the Helsinki Accords that that Brezhnev made a big deal out of signing. Well, that having been said, we see that Brezhnev is thinking very dialectically here. You know, on the one hand, he comes to power with the understanding that he is going to restore Stalin, but there's a major issue, and the major issue is a slowdown, stagnation, and then reversal in the fortunes of the Soviet economy. The defection of the Chinese in 1960-1961 is a major blow to Soviet prestige. Yugoslavia is basically an independent country now, playing east off against west. Hungary and Czechoslovakia have embarrassed, as well as East Germany, have embarrassed the Soviet system. The fact that tanks need to be used in all of those cases is a humiliation to Soviet foreign policy. So by the mid-1970s, it's clear that something else needs to be done. How do we make up for these problems? And I should note, and we'll deal with this in more detail some other time, but I should note that Khrushchev's Virgin Lands failure is really an underrated failure in Soviet economic history. The Virgin Lands program was an attempt to transfer millions of Soviet citizens to Central Asia to take advantage of these very large, open, and uninhabited tracts of fertile land and plant them. You really essentially create Ukrainian and Russian colonies in these areas to make them fertile and increase the crop yields of the Soviet Union that have been declining for a very long period of time. After Stalin's death, the Soviet economy will go into a large, very long, drawn-out death. From 1954-55 to the late 70s, the Soviet economy will slowly begin to dismantle itself. The Virgin Lands failure is one of the major milestones in this long, drawn-out failure. It is a miserable failure, partially because Khrushchev will not provide the new settlers with storage facilities. He will not build proper roads. He will not provide the proper tractors and fuel all it essentially is, you know, with the exception of the first year, all it really is a mass transfer of population. It's been theorized that Khrushchev's only real interest in this major population transfer is to destroy Ukrainian nationalism. Both Khrushchev and Brezhnev are of Ukrainian background, and they were very much threatened by the Ukrainian nationalist movement. It's not an accident that a large number of the deportees were of Ukrainian background. So, you know, this is one of the reasons that Khrushchev really was a miserable failure, even by Soviet standards. And the Virgin Lands program, once it came out in the West, was a huge humiliation. Never fear, though, because the United States, allegedly this major foe of Marxism, bailed out the Soviet Union again and again and again. This is a point that I'm going to deal with many times on this show. The fact is, the U.S. was not an anti-communist power throughout the Cold War. While it's true that they fought Soviet expansionism in Korea and Vietnam, Africa and elsewhere, at the same time, as this was all going on, the U.S. had open trading relations with the USSR. And when the Virgin Lands program will fail in Khrushchev's early years, and the Soviet Union is facing famine, the Soviet Union is facing major unrest, the United States, as well as the Canadians, will come to the aid of the USSR and bail them out with not only low-interest loans, but massive shipments of grain. And by the way, the power that was backing this major, one of many bailouts of the USSR throughout the Cold War, was Archer Daniels Midland. This ADM is a pro-socialist, pro-globalist corporate entity, and they did have a sense that they wanted to work with the Soviet Union, they wanted to trade with the Soviet Union. And so after Khrushchev's miserable Virgin Lands program, ADM lobbied the U.S. government, and as well as with the Canadian government, and bailed out the Soviet Union. Now, ADM did keep the USSR afloat, but at the same time, it was also a humiliation to Soviet foreign policy, Soviet domestic policy, and the West maintained this notion that the Soviet Union economically was in big trouble. However, it needs to be noted that CIA figures on the Soviet economy did not reflect this. And this is a very important concept we're going to come back to a lot in this show. The fact is that the CIA likely knew that the Soviet economy was far weaker than they were reporting. When the Soviet economy will begin to implode in the late 80s, none of the CIA figures will match this. The U.S., I mean, even, you know, the basic foreign policy community did not predict the fall of the Soviet Union, largely based on the fact that the CIA was producing bogus figures, overstating the strength of the Soviet economy. But, you know, late 50s, early 60s, it was fairly clear the failure of the Virgin Lands program, one of the many reasons that the KGB had to get rid of Khrushchev, suggests that there were severe problems in logistics, in planning, in military leadership, and in ideological cohesiveness within the party that was making the Soviet economy suffer. All right, I'll give you guys a break for a few minutes. We'll be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more on The Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com.
We'll be right back.
let's return to The Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, my friends, we have been talking on this show about the fall of Nikita Khrushchev and the rise of Leonid Brezhnev. And we're dealing with these immensely important topics, topics that aren't dealt with very much out there, particularly Brezhnev. I think Khrushchev has gotten a lot more attention than Brezhnev has in the literature over the years. But we've been dealing with the early years of Leonid Brezhnev with the understanding that this was the beginning of the end of the Soviet system. I'm willing to hold the view that the Brezhnev years are the last gasp of the Stalinist system. It is the last time that Stalinism will be openly attempted in the USSR, and that in 1985, when Gorbachev is chosen by the party to take over, that he realizes that since the Brezhnev experiment failed, as badly as the Khrushchev experiment failed in terms of liberalization up until 1964, that it's time for a different course. Brezhnev, in the early 70s, will say something very, very bizarre. He'll say that the Soviet Union has reached an era of what he calls developed socialism. That the years of building are now over. What we now have, the end of the dictatorship of the proletariat and the beginning of real Marxism, of real communism, the way Karl Marx had preached it. Now, the fact that there is zero evidence that the Soviet Union was doing well economically at the time, they most certainly were not doing well at the time. The fact is that the Soviet Union, from the early 70s onward, is facing substantial economic slowdown, and by the mid-1970s, substantial economic reverses. It should also be noted, the same time that Brezhnev makes his speech in the early 1970s, that developed socialism is here, the Soviet Union is now an equal to any other economic system on the planet, you have the development of the Russian mafia. Russian mafia comes out of this pathetic attempt to re-Stalinize the country in the early years of Leonid Brezhnev. What will happen is that as the economy slows down substantially in the 1970s, a very strong black market organization will come and rise up to take up the slack. Now, here are a few issues here. It's because these crime bosses will eventually dominate the former Soviet Union in the 1990s, at least until Putin will eliminate some of the worst of that element, they're responding to a number of things. And we need to make a few things clear. Issue number one, the initial crime gangs in the Soviet Union were former Gulag inmates. They had made many contacts within the Gulag system. And when they are released, they are basically persona non grata in Soviet society, and so they go underground. Issue number two, these groups are largely Jewish in their ethnic background, and so they have that kind of ethnic solidarity that make their business enterprises early on fairly successful. Issue number three, at the beginning of this program, we talked briefly about the concept of consumer goods versus heavy industry. Brezhnev made it very clear that we are not going to follow the mentality of Kosygin or Khrushchev in dealing with production of consumer goods, the goods for market, the goods that people actually want, rather than the economic basis of the country in coal and oil and steel, shipbuilding, et cetera, military production. The black market gangs, the beginning of the Russian mafia, will fill that gap as well. And the last issue, finally, is that as the Soviet economy does worse and worse over time, the fact remains that the black market, these criminal gangs, these underworld gangs, will pick up a lot of the economic slack. There's no real reliable estimates on what percentage of the Soviet GDP was in fact black market in the 1970s. We don't really know their relative strength. But the very fact that they were able to function, the very fact that they did very well economically, suggests that they were able to bribe their way to wealth and power, that as the Soviet economy showed more and more areas of weakness, these criminal gangs were able to fill those gaps. And in fact, the Soviet government had absolutely no interest in doing anything against these gangs, partially because of the ethnic issue, partially because they were contributing so much to the Soviet economy, that they were keeping a lid on domestic dissent. Domestic dissent in the 1970s, after the signing of the Helsinki Accords in 1975, domestic dissent had an ethnic basis, you know, Ukrainians and Balts who didn't want to be a part of the USSR anymore, religious dissent, but it also had to do with the lack of consumer goods. The fact is that party members in the USSR did far better than anybody else. They had access to Western goods. They had access to goods made in Great Britain and the United States. They had access to cars and vacation homes that were not available to any other member of the population. So you have this weird Orwellian world of Soviet politics the mid-1970s, where you have substantial crop failures that come from Khrushchev's disastrous agricultural policy. By the way, it's not an accident that Mikhail Gorbachev, when he's selected by the party to take over in 1985, he used to be the agriculture minister under Brezhnev. The very fact that the party chooses Gorbachev, whose specialization was in agriculture, suggests that food shortages were a major problem. Now, the black market was involved in things like records, things like Western clothing, things like cheap alcohol and Western drugs, pornography and prostitution. But, you know, they were involved also with providing things like bread and milk and beer and, you know, basic necessities of infinitely higher quality than the planned economy was creating. So the Brezhnev regime was probably aware that these people existed, probably aware of their importance, and as a result, not a whole lot was ever done against them until Putin takes over from a very sick Boris Yeltsin in 1999. The mid-70s, late-70s, the Soviet Union is forced to admit defeat and begin importing food from the West. How does the Soviet Union deal with this? The Soviet Union is clearly embarrassed on the world stage. On the one hand, Brezhnev is talking about developed socialism, the fact that we have reached parity with the U.S., the fact that socialism now doesn't have to be authoritarian anymore. We are now the true spokesman for the proletariat. All this nonsense, while he is tolerating the black market and the criminal gangs that control it. He has to import food from the West. The West, by the way, more than happy to supply and bail out the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union would have died 1,000 deaths prior to the 1970s, but the West, led by the United States, was there to bail out the Soviet Union over and over and over again. I will hold, and I will debate anybody on this topic. The fact is the Soviet Union is as much the creation of the U.S. as it is of any kind of domestic or foreign communist conspiracy. The U.S. bailed out Lenin. The U.S. bailed out Stalin. The U.S. bailed out Khrushchev. And again, it is bailing out Leonid Brezhnev. There was never a time when the Soviet Union was capable of feeding itself. It was absolutely, agriculture was the big weakness. of the Soviet system, starting with the dismantling of the new economic policy after Lenin's death, the collectivization of agriculture in Ukraine and Central Asia, some very fertile areas. Soviet Union was never able to feed itself. The Soviet Union was fed for generations by the United States at the same time the U.S. is allegedly waging a war on communism. This should tell you something about the mentality of U.S. foreign policy throughout the so-called Cold War.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
One of the ways that Brezhnev will respond to this is a very weak attempt to recreate Stalin's personality cult with him at the center. Another response will be the invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, and the last response will be Brezhnev's own drug addiction. Brezhnev was addicted when he finally died. He was addicted to Nembutal. Nembutal is really was a very powerful sleep aid, sleep drug. He had this very mysterious KGB nurse that kept feeding him Nembutal on a fairly regular basis. By the time he died, he was completely incoherent. So these are the three things. I also think that the Helsinki Accords, an attempt to deal with the West over the nuclear issue under Nixon and then later under Ford and Carter, that these are also attempts to rescue the reputation of the Soviet Union abroad. Brezhnev will also develop something that most people know fairly well. They know as the Brezhnev Doctrine, and it really is, there are 4 points specifically. Point number one, the Soviet Union is dedicated to attacking and destroying with all the resources at its disposal, any kind of counter-revolutionary movement within its sphere of influence. Secondly, it justified the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968 on that very same basis. Number three, it justified the integrity of the Warsaw Pact. The Warsaw Pact was meant to be, in spite of the Helsinki Accords, was meant to be a single unit run by the Soviet Union. Any deviation from that will lead to major military intervention. 1989, Erich Honecker, who was the dictator of East Germany, had appealed to Gorbachev for tanks to use against his domestic dissidents on the basis of the Brezhnev Doctrine. And Gorbachev said, no, I'm sorry, the Brezhnev Doctrine has been repealed. And lastly, the Helsinki Accords are given a new interpretation, and the way that the Brezhnev state will interpret the Helsinki Accords is by saying that since they hold, I mean, only a Soviet, ideologue can ever say this, but since it guarantees self-determination, it must also guarantee Soviet self-determination. Therefore, any Western attempt to alter the politics of Eastern Europe or Vietnam or Ethiopia or any other Soviet colony, Cuba, will be met by violent opposition from the Soviet Union. So ultimately, the Brezhnev government and the KGB and the military establishment will completely twist the Helsinki Accords to its own uses. And that's the Brezhnev doctrine. Brezhnev will invade Afghanistan in 1979 based on this doctrine. A lot of your old guard Stalinists in Eastern Europe who will topple in the late 80s, they also will appeal to assistance with the Soviet Union based on the Brezhnev doctrine, which by the mid-80s is largely a dead letter. So, let me conclude here. Let me conclude by saying, make eight specific points. I want to make these eight specific points because they deal with the eventual fall and destruction of the Soviet Union. There is no understanding of the fall of the USSR without understanding Leonid Brezhnev. That's why we took the entire hour here today dealing with Brezhnev. He is a major figure, if for no other reason than as a negative phenomenon. He is a negative figure in that he is a representative of the stagnation and then eventual decline of the Soviet Union as an economic power. So when Gorbachev is installed by the KGB in 1985, he is faced with economic problems so severe that he really has no choice but to attempt to free prices, to stop bailing out failing industries, and these other things that mark the Gorbachev reforms, because Brezhnev and the two very short-lived successors, Andropov and Tryanka, so Brezhnev and his successors have delivered to Gorbachev a failed economy, deeply in debt, and by 1980, completely dependent on Western money. The fact is, and I'll repeat this as many times as necessary, there would be no Soviet Union without American support. So, issue number one. The Brezhnev regime is marked by a complete absence of revolutionary fervor. That generation is gone. That generation has been decimated by Stalin, by Khrushchev, now by Brezhnev. What you have is a bureaucratic dictatorship. Brezhnev has no particular charisma. He is scientifically intelligent, but he has no particular political abilities. And really, issue number two, you have the domination of a bureaucratic clique of party members over any kind of new ideas. Gorbachev will break this. Gorbachev has to break this. Number three, because of the domination of bureaucratic politics over anything else, there are no new initiatives. The last real big thing, the last real big push the Soviet Union will engage in is under Khrushchev, and that's the Virgin Lands Program, which is an absolute disaster and causes famine in the Soviet Union, which, as always, is met by massive aid and assistance by the by the United States, led by Archer Daniels Midland. Issue number four, how does Brezhnev deal with this? He deals with it through propaganda, the cult of personality, the Helsinki Accords, talks with the West, lots of high-profile meetings with Western leaders, being nice to Yugoslavia, being nice to the Chinese, these kind of things. How many people believe it? We don't really know. I mean, ultimately, 1979, the invasion of Afghanistan will be the very last-ditch attempt to deal with a failed Soviet economy. Issue number five, the Soviet Union is now a completely militarized state. The military are the state. The military control the state. This is why Brezhnev was created in the first place, because he was a part of the military establishment in its high-tech area. Issue number six, Brezhnev will engage in a full-scale attempt to destroy dissidents. That is, those dissidents that don't exactly promote the economy. So the criminal gangs will be left alone. I mean, they'll be harassed by the cops every once in a while, but for the most part, they have enough cash given their role in the economy that we've talked about already, that they're able to buy their way out of anything. Issue number seven, the economy will simply decline. There'll be a growing, what we call an informal sector or a black market sector. The state for the first time is going to be challenged by these entities. Ultimately, what happens is, by the mid-80s, late-80s, Gorbachev engages on this substantial amount of reform to attempt to free the economy, which is already imploding. Who takes over? It's the criminal gangs who will take over. And this, even the U.S. government knew this. Harvard University knew this. When they went over in the late-80s and early 90s to restructure the Soviet economy, the IMF knew this. The World Bank knew this. The CIA knew this. They deliberately empowered this group of overwhelmingly Jewish criminal gangs in the old Soviet Union who took over the economy in the 1990s. The last issue, and really the last powerful symbol of Soviet decline in the 70s, is Brezhnev engaged in a series of spending measures on military things and the development of the space program, which was his initial area of specialty. Under Khrushchev. You know, but these priorities were engaged in by the Soviet apparatus without any reference to how much they might cost. So when it became clear that the invasion of Afghanistan was a complete failure, the fact remained that the Soviet Union had no money. And so this situation, early 80s, will eventually lead to the decline and fall of the Soviet Union, which, as we all know, is a very, very good thing, with one exception. And the one exception is the destruction of the Soviet Union, which was a fact. It was a fact that Brezhnev helped bring about, really did one thing, and it empowered a mafia-controlled state from the 1980s, really up until the late 1990s, until the reforms of Putin. And we will deal with those reforms in some detail on this show eventually, and we will get to that one day. In the meantime, I want to thank you guys for listening. I hope you found this interesting. You're not going to hear a lot of this stuff anywhere else. I appreciate you guys. I appreciate the support of the Voice of Reason, of Mike and Dietrich and everybody else. I appreciate their friendship, and I am signing off. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to